From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A number of countries in Latin America have been racked by political violence over the past several weeks. Most recently, Bolivian authorities announced on Monday night that President Evo Morales has likely won re-election and possibly narrowly avoided a runoff. Riots erupted in response amid accusations of unfairness in the election. In Chile, mass protests have led to nearly a dozen deaths in just a few days as Chileans revolted against an increase in subway fares that they say unfairly targets ordinary people. President Sebastián Piñera, a billionaire who was elected in 2017, has declared war against the protesters. Ecuador has also been struck with anti-austerity protests as President Lenin Moreno agreed to cancel a package of reforms backed by the International Monetary Fund. And in Peru, earlier this month, President Martín Vizcarra abruptly dissolved the country's Congress, leading Congress members to suspend him. Elections are expected there in January. My guest is Guillaume Long, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Welcome to the program, Guillaume.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So protests everywhere. Different stories in all these four countries in Latin America that neighbor one another, that are all clustered together. Let's start with Bolivia. President Evo Morales was running for re-election. And there were a lot of news reports ahead of the election that suggested that he would likely have to face a runoff. As far as we know, and we know that things could change because this is a rapidly changing story, what do we know now about Morales and whether he has managed to avoid a runoff?
Well, we know that it's a very tight race. And when you have tight races, both sides eager to either claim victory or to defend their position, and it polarizes things. And tight races, we've had a lot of them in Latin America, in the history of Latin America, and they create these kinds of situations. The current situation is that Evo Morales is very close to getting the 10 points difference he needs on his closest opponent in the first round ballot in order to avoid a runoff. So you need in Bolivia, in order to be elected president, you either need 50% plus one or 40% at least with a 10 point difference with the next contender. Now, so far, it's looking pretty close to 46-36. Now, of course, if it's 45.9 versus 36, then you have to have a second round. You have to have a runoff. But if it's 46.1 versus 36, then Evo Morales would be elected. So this is what the situation, I mean, this is, the votes are still being counted right now. And a lot of early votes that came in to feed the electoral system came in from places where there were of easier access, so urban areas, and those tended to favor the opposition. But a lot of late coming votes are rural votes who tend to favor Evo Morales, the incumbent president. So you're seeing early results suggesting that maybe there would be a runoff. But now, as the votes from the rural areas are coming in, there is a greater possibility, even probability, that Evo Morales might be elected in a single round of presidential elections. So this is what the unrest is about, and there's been some violence indeed. Evo Morales himself came out to call for patience and for a peaceful outcome to the elections, but we'll have to see what happens.
So the Western media, as is often the case when it comes to left-leaning Latin American leaders, has pretty biased coverage of what was happening in Bolivia. For example, just one example is the Wall Street Journal. Here's one headline: Bolivia's socialist anti-American president fights to stay in power. It seems as though a lot of Western media had predicted that Morales might not win this, what would be his fourth term in office. Do you view a lot of the coverage as pretty biased against him?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I think largely speaking, Western media coverage, obviously it depends what media, and there are all sorts of exceptions to that rule. But yeah, generally speaking, Western media coverage has been pretty hostile to left-leaning governments in Latin America, you know, in general, certainly with regards to Bolivia. I think that the polls were very heterogeneous. Polling is sort of famously difficult in Bolivia because there are a lot of rural areas. You know, so in the last elections that Evo Morales has won, polls didn't always favor him, or they favored him, but not as much as the ultimate results favored him because of that rural variable. Right, where he always has an overwhelming majority of votes in areas which don't always enter the polls. So you have to be conservative when you look at the polls. The last polls were, you know, or rather the other way around. You know, sometimes the polls are too conservative when it comes to gauging what the mass, Evo Morales' party, and Evo Morales' vote is on the day of the elections. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate to see. Generally speaking, the media, both in Latin America and outside Latin America, sort of polarizing things further. I think, you know, what we need right now is to wait for the electoral authorities to count every vote. Clearly, the quick count, which gives you a general impression of what's going on election night, is fine when there's a big difference, right? When, you know, the margin of error is not going to make that much of a difference. But when you're looking at those kinds of decimals that we're looking at, even if, you know, Evo Morales has a very healthy lead, the question is here is whether there is a second round, whether there's a runoff. And that is going to be played on a very small amount of votes. You know, I was looking earlier at the variations from 1 hour to the next. There's a runoff, then there's no runoff, then there's a runoff, then there's no runoff. And this is all like 5,000, 6,000 votes up or down, right? So I think it's really important that, you know, we all have this kind of democratic maturity and wait for the electoral authorities, the OEP in Bolivia, that's the name of the institutions, to make the call. And avoid, of course, violence, which is what should be avoided at all costs.
Going back to the issue of Western media coverage, Morales is being portrayed as a leader who wants to remain in power forever because this would be his fourth term. He's been in power for 13 years. Of course, that same standard is rarely applied to countries where U.S. leaders are considered allies. And let's talk about his closest rival, Carlos Mesa, who was president in the early 2000s for about a year and a half. What does he represent politically that is different from what Morales represents?
Well, I think he represents certainly a turn to the right. And let's not forget that in Latin America, roughly since 2014, 2015, there has been a sharp rightward swing, which actually, interestingly, and maybe we'll talk about that, is being challenged. In the last few months, we're seeing that the rightward swing is coming to a grind, to a halt. But certainly, Carlos Mesa would represent that. The right wing is supporting him. I would say the corporate media, the big landowners, a lot of the kind of business sectors, the upper classes, and some important sectors of the middle classes are also supporting Carlos Mesa against Evo Morales. He is actually himself self-portrayed social democrat, so he's not from the far right. But he's managed to get sort of, I would say, hard right support because he's more or less managed to unify the opposition against Morales.
And is that, are it his supporters that are out in the streets rioting and are upset about the possibility of Morales avoiding a runoff?
Yeah, whether they're his direct supporters or more generally opponents of a Morales re-election. Because there are a lot of people who are voting for Mesa just because they don't want Morales anymore. Yes, I think that a significant amount of the violence we've seen over the last few hours comes from those quarters. However, you know, political violence, once it erupts, it can come from either side. And what we need to avoid here is certainly is polarization that leads supporters of both candidates resolving their differences not in the ballot box but in the streets or through. And we've seen a few people burning, voting booths and ballot boxes and so on and so forth, still on a small scale. But we certainly wouldn't want this to be on the large scale or to affect the election electoral results. Mm-hmm. But Mesa himself has been president, actually. He was a caretaker president when the former president of Bolivia, Sanchez de Lozada, actually had to flee the country back in 2002, 2003. There was a lot of political instability in Bolivia. And Carlos Mesa was briefly, having been vice president, a caretaker president of Bolivia. So people know him already. He wasn't initially a huge opponent of Morales, but he has certainly become one, and he succeeded in uniting the opposition against Evo Morales with what I would call a sort of standard neoliberal discourse, right? Back to sort of a much more pro-market, pro-business, pro-US. This is important, geopolitically speaking, in the region right now. Policies in general, more right-wing policies, I would say, as opposed to Morales' more socialist policies.
And then in neighboring Chile, just to the west of Bolivia, you have massive unrest as well. Here we've seen even greater levels of violence, not around an election. There have been almost a dozen people, I understand, so far killed as mass protests erupted against policies put forward by Chile's billionaire president, Sebastián Piñera. It's being cast, at least on the surface, as a revolt against an increase in subway fares. But it's about much more than that, right?
Yeah, I think that's the tip of the iceberg, definitely. We're seeing transport fares in Chile and in other parts of Latin America, including in Ecuador. But we're seeing the cost of transport and public transport sparking unrest and protests. But behind that, there is, of course, much deeper social issues. I think in Chile is one of the most unequal countries in Latin America and one of the most unequal countries in the world. And, the pressure cooker has been on the stove for a while, and it's been mounting and mounting, and the security valve isn't on, and it's exploded. And certainly the protest has been met by the images we're seeing coming out of Chile are very worrying. The level of repression reminds us of very sadder days, the days of the military dictatorship in Chile. It has to be said that the carabineros, the police in Chile, have always had strong-handed attitude to protests. The heavy-handed, they're famous for it. The riot police always deals with unrest rather swiftly, and repression is, I think it's fair to say, is frequent and pretty intimidating. But this is on a different level altogether. We're talking of several deaths, some people shot with live ammunition, more than 1,300 arrests, tanks on the streets, curfew. When you talk of curfew in Latin America, this is very symbolic. Curfew in Latin America reminds us Latin Americans, and include myself, the days of military authoritarianism, right? This is what it smacks of. And so, Chile, very worrying situation unfolding right now.
Sebastián Piñera has declared war on the protesters. He has described them as organized criminals and enemies of the state. Now, are the protests, as far as you can tell, organized under some sort of political party or behind some sort of political party or organization, or are they, at least in these early stages, much more spontaneous?
I think it's very spontaneous, and I think it's very heterogeneous. So, of course, the opposition, particularly the leftist opposition is involved. But I, you know, all this narrative, and it's been happening in other countries, also in Ecuador, that this is some kind of an international conspiracy with Venezuelan backing and sort of taking away the self-determination and the capacity to decide for themselves of the Chilean people. This kind of narrative, which is coming from the Chilean government, I think is ill-conceived. I think what you're seeing is a government carrying out very aggressive structural adjustment program in a context, the Chilean context, let's not forget, that's already one of the most neoliberal contexts in Latin America. The Pinochet reforms were very aggressive, very pro-market, took away a lot of the safety nets. And this current government, the Piñera government, is putting another layer of sort of deregulation on top of all this, which is creating a precariousness, a social vulnerability, which is now expressing itself through this with these social protests. So very spontaneous from a lot of different quarters, some unions, but also a lot of sort of students and also neighborhood demonstrations, very sort of fragmented and heterogeneous form of politics, protesting these neoliberal reforms. So I really don't buy into this kind of international conspiracy, trying to blame everything on Venezuela. I think Maduro has already got quite a lot on his plate in Venezuela. And I don't think, you know, we're not talking about, this is not a huge imperial nation that has the capacity to really meddle that much outside of its borders. But this is the narrative that's coming out. And you mentioned the president mentioning warfare. He had to retract a few hours later. But I think this is worrying language. It's language that goes back to a tradition of sort of counterinsurgency, anti-communist jargon, and going back to the Cold War, essentially, and to the national security state. And Chile, you know, has been scarred by that. There's a lot of memory there. There are a lot of human rights abuses that come from that period. It's really, I think, instead of lowering tensions, this sparks even more popular anger and brings out even more people on the streets, essentially.
I'm always interested in how the Western media, especially the corporate media in the U.S., covers Latin American stories. And the New York Times, interestingly enough, on Tuesday had a very good editorial piece. This is by the New York Times' editorial board, entitled Chile Learns the Price of Economic Inequality. And the editorial board said Chile is not suffering from a lack of resources, but instead from an unsustainably narrow conception of its obligation to its citizens. And it goes on to say the obvious path for Chile is for the government to spend more money improving the quality of life for a vast majority of Chileans who are exposed to the vicissitudes of a market economy while being denied a sufficient share of the benefits. I sort of wish the New York Times would view the U.S. Economy through that same lens, but I was sort of surprised by that accurate acknowledgement of the economic inequality you were talking about.
Yeah, I think that's Latin America's Achilles heel, you know. Mm-hmm. Actually, if you look at Latin America as a continent, you know, if you look at per capita GDP, so if you look at the average, it's the global middle class, right? It's not as poor as other parts of the global south, and certainly not as rich as industrialized world. But those averages hide huge disparities. And Latin America as a region is the most unequal region in the world. So inequality is the great social ill of Latin America. And I think you'll find, I mean, obviously there are all sorts of variables and all sorts of caveats and all sorts of different contextual things that you'd have to bring in according to different countries. But the common denominator of all the social protests in Latin America is the return of inequality. For the last 3-4 years, there is a new wave of neoliberal reform. And Latin Americans have already been, Latin America was the laboratory of neoliberalism, actually starting in Chile in the 1970s, and then under democratic rule in the 1980s and 1990s, it was the laboratory of neoliberal adjustment, structural adjustment program. It was where the IMF really started acquiring most of its might and applying its recipes. And then for a decade and a half, at the beginning of 21st century, you had left-leaning governments that sought, you know, alternatives to neoliberalism, a sort of Latin American New Deal, and it's been called different things, but bringing the state back in order to try and redistribute some of the wealth and power and create more public investment to stimulate growth and anti-austerity programs, so on and so forth. And that came to a halt in 2015 with the great commodities decline in Latin America. And what we've had in a number of countries in Latin America since 2015 is a return of neoliberal recipes, the presence of the IMF in a number of countries, applying what I would call a rather fundamentalist agenda. And the reaction, you know, is not immediate. It takes a few months, in some cases a few years. But the reaction you're seeing in Chile, in Ecuador, also in Argentina, fortunately in Argentina is through electoral means, but is a basically anti-neoliberal protest.
So let's turn to Ecuador then, speaking specifically of the IMF and those anti-austerity, or those austerity packages. Can you explain that essentially this similar thing to what you were just discussing is also happening in Ecuador, with President Lenin Moreno actually having been forced to capitulate to protesters' demands and withdraw an IMF package?
Yeah, I think the situation in Ecuador is somewhat different from the situation in Chile, although it bears some similarities. Lenin Moreno was elected on a platform of continuation from his predecessor, Rafael Correa, only to declare 6 weeks into his presidency that, and I quote, "I'm starting to hate the people who voted for me and preferring the people who voted against me."
Wow.
So that was, you know, a problematic statement, to say the least. And he basically has been governing with the people who were actually stood against him in the election. So his minister of finance was the chief advisor to Moreno's opponent in the presidential elections. And he's basically completely shifted 180 degrees from Correa's program to a very aggressive neoliberal program. So for 2.5 years, people were really confused. It took a long time for protests to emerge, you know, to feel that they had essentially been conned, that they voted for someone on a platform of continuation, and what was happening was exactly the reverse of what they voted for. But so they were gradual neoliberal reforms, and suddenly there was this big package that was negotiated with the IMF, which had three main pillars. One, taking away fuel subsidies, which seriously affects the transport, well, public transport, obviously, but also the transport of goods, and particularly food, which immediately started having an inflationary effect on the price of basic foodstuffs. The second element was cutting the wages of public functionaries, civil servants, and cutting their holidays by half, which is quite aggressive, you know, from 30 days holidays, which what the public functionaries, civil servants were entitled to 15 days paid leave. So I think that would probably spark protests in most parts of the world. And then finally, a more kind of monetary macroeconomic package. Ecuador's a dollarized economy, so it's very complicated. Ecuador needs all sorts of safeguards in order to make sure that dollars don't leave its economy, because it can't print its own banknotes. So Ecuador has to make sure. So there are taxes on dollars leaving the economy, and there are a few tariffs on imports to make sure that the balance of payments is okay, and that you're not left without any dollars at the ATM, because that causes a run on the banks. And then if you have a run on the banks, then that jeopardizes the whole financial system. And so the IMF asked for these taxes to be lifted, you know, big, big, very aggressive neoliberal package in Ecuador. This was met by mass protest. And again, 13 days of unprecedented protest in the last decades in Ecuador. And this is the biggest protest in the last half century, at least in Ecuador, with still an undisclosed amount of deaths, at least 7, but it could be double. Nobody really knows. 500 people injured, 1,200 people arrested, and eventually Moreno backing down on the fuel subsidy aspect of the economic package. Unfortunately, what we're seeing is now that the demonstrations have resided, now that the situation is kind of peaceful again, and, you know, things got really bad. I mean, in Ecuador, the Moreno government had to flee the capital, you know, had to go to Guayaquil, the other large city in Ecuador. So, you know, he was almost removed. In the end, the military stood by him, but Moreno was always removed. But what we're seeing since the situation has pacified again is Moreno arresting key opponents, opposition figures, in Ecuador, and a number of people have sought exile in the Mexican embassy in Ecuador, basically supporters of Rafael Correa fleeing the country or being arrested. So here too, a slide towards authoritarianism, a sort of neoliberal authoritarianism seeping in Ecuador in a dangerous way.
Finally, Guillaume, gosh, there's so much to talk about. We barely have 2 minutes left in our conversation. What happened in Peru? Late September, early October, the president, Martin Vizcarra, dissolved Congress. Congress suspended him. There are now elections in January. Can you give us a brief nutshell of what was happening in Peru and what's expected now?
Very briefly, Peru's been in a systemic political crisis for a long time now, with several of its former presidents being incarcerated, accused on corruption charges. Former President Kuczynski, who the last president to be elected, who quit because of corruption charges. Vizcarra, the current president himself, is a caretaker president. He was himself vice president, but he doesn't have a majority in Congress. So you have this constant fighting between Congress that's largely dominated by Fujimorismo, so the followers of former President Fujimori, and the presidency, so a legislative, executive sort of deadlock there. Finally, Vizcarra managing to organize new elections for January, despite the fact that he had to dissolve Congress in the process. So a big wave of instability here. But maybe the difference in Peru compared to some of the other contexts we've discussed is that this is not huge popular protests. We're not seeing a massive mobilization of civil society, of people. This is essentially institutional infighting between different branches of government, the legislative, the executive, political parties at loggerheads with each other. It's more of a systemic political crisis than a real mass citizens' protests against an economic system, despite the fact that, of course, in Peru, it's a very aggressive brand of neoliberalism that's being implemented too.
Right.
So we'll have to follow that story, but for the time being, new elections in January in Peru.
Guillaume, thank you so much for this breakneck review of these four Latin American countries. We didn't even get to some others there, but I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been Guillaume Long, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which you can find online at cepr.net. We've been discussing political instability in various Latin American countries. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.